We're holding on to Sadiq Aleph Ahmed Bey's 11 lines from the bottom, the fourth line of the widest lines. We're in the middle of a piece of Agadah where we talked about Elimelech and Machlon and Kilian and their families leaving Eretz Yisrael for Chutz Laaretz during a time of drought, during a time of famine at the beginning of Megillas Rus, because we were learning that you're not supposed to do that except under certain limited circumstances. And that led into a whole piece of Agadah talking about various aspects of their story. So the last thing was we brought a pasuk from Divrei Yomim, where all of Divrei Yomim, or at least the beginning of it, with all the genealogies, is really meant for darshaning. And it mentioned a pasuk over there that mentioned a bunch of people and groups that are all that the pasuk in the context is they're all members of Shevet Yehuda. The ones that the Gemara identifies them are not actually all from Shevet Yehuda, but Marsha explains the point is that it's putting together various people who came close to Hashem, where you wouldn't have expected them to, and then vice versa, some people who did not, who actually went away from Hashem, but Hashem still orchestrated it, that from them is going to come something good. So we said, the Pasuk had said, Yoikim, the Yoikim, which we said referred to Yeshua, the Anshei Chizeva, referred to the Givonim, we said referred to Machlon and Kilian, so even though they acted wrongly by leaving Eretz Yisrael, in the end Hashem made that that there came from them the whole story of Megillas Rus and the whole genesis of Malchus Beis David. We said referred to Rus herself. We said that Hashem orchestrated all of this happen, that all of this would happen. Hashem made it all happen. So now the Gemara continues with darshaning the next pasuk there in Divrei Yomim. The next pasuk continues, Hema HaYotzrim, they are the makers. The simple meaning of a yotzer means like a potter. So the simple meaning would be, the surface meaning would be that these people mentioned in the previous pasuk were potters, but here the Gemara is going to darshan it differently. So Hema HaYotzrim, they are the makers, the Yoshvei Netoyim, and the ones who lived in Netoyim, in the place of the plantings, or Gdera, and the fences, Imam Melech B'Malachta, Yoshvusham, they sat there, they stayed there together with the king doing his work. So again, the surface meaning, and Mephoshim on the Pasuk say as much, that it's describing that these families mentioned in the previous Pesukim were doing these jobs on behalf of the king. So now the Gemara Darshins, Hema HaYotzrim, the Yotzrim of the Pasuk, refers to Eile B'nei Yonadav ben Rechav, refers to the descendants of Yonadav ben Rechav, Shenotzru Shvua Savihem, where they preserved the Shvua of their father, Yotzrim Elosh Notzar. The story, Sefer Yirmiyah tells the story. Yonadav ben Rechav himself is a descendant of Yisra. He lived in the time, in the middle of the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. He's mentioned in a story in Malachim, in connection with Yehu, when Yehu overthrew the family of Achav and became king. Anyway, in Sefer Yirmiyah, it tells how this Yonadav ben Rechav told his children and for all their descendants after them, they should do various things to demonstrate that they recognize that they're not living permanently in this world. They shouldn't live in permanent houses, only in tents. They shouldn't have fields or vineyards, and they shouldn't drink wine. All of this was meant to that they should live their lives realizing they're only passing through the world temporarily, and they did that. And even a couple of hundred years after Yonadav's times, Yirmiyah tries to convince them to drink wine, and they tell them no, our ancestor Yonadav ben Rechav told us not to, and we're still following what he says. And Hashem tells Yirmiyah to tell the Jewish people, look at that, you were listening to the commands of a boss of a dumb. Even a couple of hundred years later, why aren't you listening to Hashem when he tells you what to do and what not to do? And Hashem also promises that as a result for their faithfulness in keeping their father's shvua. And he says, Lo yikoris ish li Yonadav ben Rechav oimen l'fanei kol hayomim, there will always be people of Yonadav ben Rechav's descendants in leadership positions among the Jewish people. Interestingly, the Yerushalmi brings that Rabbi Yossi, the Tana, was a descendant of theirs. So there's one example of it. Anyway, so the Yotzrim of this pasuk refers to that family of Yonadav ben Rechav. Again, following Marsha's approach to it from that we started discussing yesterday, then it means they're obviously not physically descended from Shevet Yehuda, but it means they're among this group of people who are working on coming closer to Hashem. So that Yoshvin then when it says the dwellers of Netoyim, that refers to Shlomo HaMelech, who was like a young sapling, like a young planting in his kingship. He started out young. He was king only, he was only 12 years old when he became king, and he became greater and greater. Rashbam brings the pasuk that he was sitting al kisei Hashem lamelech, that he was sitting on Hashem's throne, and we know he ruled over the Shadim and the Malachim and everything. So he was like a small sapling that becomes greater and greater. Ugdera, when the pasuk continues, and Gdera, which means a fence, Zu Sanhedrin shegodru pirtisei in Shal Yisrael, that refers to the Sanhedrin who worked together with David HaMelech, who fenced in the breaches of the Jewish people, meaning when people are going to be, going to be doing Averis, then they would work to make Xeris and Takonis to fix things up and prevent people from doing that. They make a siyag la-Torah, like it says in Pirkei Avos. When the pasuk continues, Im HaMelech b'Melachta Yoshvu Sham, they lived there, they dwelt there together with the king and his work. Zur Rus HaMoyaviyah, this refers again to Rus from Moyav, Shurosam Shloime Ben Bnoi Shal Ben Bna, means she actually got to see the kingship of Shloime, who was the grandson of her grandson. Her son with Boaz was Ovid, whose son was Yishai, whose son was David. So David is her great grandson, and Shloime is her great great grandson, and she got to see him as king. Shedemar, as we find a pasuk early in Shlomo's reign, the pasuk says, "Vayosim kisei le'ema melech." He set up a throne for the mother of the king. Va'amar Rabbi Elazar, "Ima shel malchus," and le'ima shel malchus. And Rabbi Elazar says that means we don't just mean the mother, as in Shlomo's own mother, Bathsheba. We mean the ancestress of the whole kingdom of Malchus Beis David, namely Ruth. So she was still alive then, even though it was generations after she had come to Eretz Yisrael and become a Giordas and married Boaz. So again, and therefore that pasuk is all we're darshaning it about the various important components of the Jewish people who were all involved in coming closer to Hashem and making and bringing the Jewish people closer to Hashem. Marsha adds a couple of details over here. For example, the reason why we're mentioning the Sanhedrin over here is because they're the ones who paskin that Rus is allowed to marry into the Jewish people. So in that sense, they fenced in that breach. And he mentions various other details over here of why the Gemara is darshining that it refers to why for example why does La'ema Melech refer to Rus, because the previous psukim are already talking about Bathsheba, so therefore so now when it has to say La'ema Melech, then it means a different mother of the kingship who hasn't been mentioned until now. All right, we had mentioned earlier in the earlier on the daf, we had talked about where there's shortages of grain and what we have to do in order to make sure that there's a supply and the various dinim in that regard. So the Gemara brings Tanur Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa, that when it says in the Psukim that if we keep Shmita, then Hashem will bring a big bracha into the grain. So when the pasuk says V'achaltim v'atvur yoshan, when it says that you're going to be able to eat from the grain when it's aged, that means below salamantum. That means you're going to be able to eat the grain when it's old without salamantin. My beloy salamantin. What does that mean? Reb Nachman Omer beloy ritzinta. Reb Nachman says so. Salamantin is something that prevents the grain from deteriorating. So what is the salamantin? So the Gemara knows what salamantin is, but in other words, it's elsewhere the Gemara talks about. It's like a sandy soil that you put into the grain, and then you mix it with the grain as a preservative. Elsewhere the Gemara calls it kav shel chumtin. Famously, the Rebbeim explained that what it is we learn nigla, but we have to also make sure that we're learning chassidus as well, and that's like the sandy soil that prevents the grain, that prevents what we're learning in nigla from rotting and deteriorating, and preserves it, that it actually enhances our connection with Hashem. Anyway, so we know what salamantin is, but what is it preventing against that the pasuk is promising? Reb Nachman Omer b'loy ritzinta. Reb Nachman says it means that the salamantin will prevent that there won't be worms that attack the grain and cause it to rot. Reb Sheshet Omer b'loy shdifa. Reb Sheshet says it means without a blast of hot wind, meaning, in other words, that would then cause if the grain is too warm, it won't age well. So Hashem is promising that He's going to make it that won't be necessary It'll stay the salmantan will help the grain stay cool and be able to be preserved. And the Gemara brings Tanya Kava Seh de Rav Sheshes for Tanya Kava Seh de Rav Nachman. We actually learn Braises like both of them. Tanya Kava Seh de Rav Nachman, when the Pasuk is of Achaltem Yoshan, when the Pasuk says you will be able to eat aged grain, this is actually a different pasuk. This is at the beginning. The other pasuk, Va'achaltem Atvor Yoshan, is in Parshas Bahar in connection with Shemitah. This one is in Bechukosai in the brachas over there. So when it says Va'achaltem, so when it says Va'achaltem Yoshan, Yoho Yisrael Mitzapin Lachodosh, you would think that means that the Jewish people are going to have to be looking forward to the new grain, Mipnei Yoshan Shekola, because the old grain has been used up. Talmud Lomar ad bo sivuasa. Therefore, the pasuk continues until the produce of it comes, meaning ad shetovet tvua me'eleha, until the new grain comes on its own. So, in other words, you're going to be able to eat from the old grain until right before the harvest of the new grain. And the point is, shekola, you would think, because meanwhile you have the old supply has been ruined by worms and has been ruined by worms or as Rav Nachman had said, ritzinta, which are worms, and therefore, and the pasuk is promising that won't be necessary. So we see from that braisa that the potential problem is worms, and the pasuk is saying you won't have that problem. Tanya Kavasei de Rav Sheshes, then we learn a braisa like Rav Sheshes, when it says Va'achaltem min atvur yoshen, you'll eat from the old grain. Yochol Yisrael mitzapen lachodosh b'pnei yoshen shera. So you would think that Jewish people are going to have to be waiting for the new grain because the old grain is bad. So that fits better with Rav Sheshes' understanding that the potential problem is shdifa, which makes that the grain is poor quality and won't age well. Talmud Lomer ad bo tvuasa, and therefore the pasuk says until the produce comes, meaning ad shetovet tvua me'eleha, until the produce comes on its own, you will have the old grain will be good to eat for a long time until the new grain is ready, and there won't be any problem of low quality and of warmth that caused the grain to deteriorate, like Rav Sheshes says. So the Gemara continues. The pasuk says again in the brachas before in the brachas in Parshas Bechukosai, it says you'll eat aged grain, and yoshen noshen is a double expression. That means it teaches us that the older the grain is, the better it is to eat. The only other dvarim should darken the yashna. Now you would only know then the pasuk is referring to things that are usually kept to age, like grain. Dvarim shein darken the yashna minayin. How do we know that the bracha is going to apply to things? And another example of something that would be usually left to age is wine. How do we know that it includes things that are not usually aged? Talmud Lomer Yoshan Noshan Mikomakam. Therefore, the pasuk says the double expression Yoshan Noshan, meaning that even things that usually are not left to age, here you're going to be able to let them age, and when this bracha is in effect in Eretz Yisrael, and it'll work and it'll be better. And when the pasuk continues V'yoshan mipnei chodesh teitziu, when it says you'll take out the old in favor of the new, that means melamed shayu otzis malei and yoshan, means you're going to have your storehouses are going to be full of old grain and wine and whatever. Gronis malei chodesh malei and chodesh. Meanwhile, the granary where you've just threshed and prepared your new crop of that year is going to be full. So the Jewish people are going to say, "Hey, Echnotzi, Zem Pnei Zeh, how? What should we do? How should we? What how, should we take out the old to make way for the new?" So, in other words, the pasuk is saying you're going to have to. It's true that the old is better, but nevertheless, you have to have some place to store the new. So, therefore, of necessity, you're going to be taking out the old to make way for the new. And the point is, Rashbam points out, ultimately, the reason why you'd want to do that is because once you've aged the grain, let's say for a year or two, there's only so much, you're aging it any further is not going to make it any better, as opposed to take the new one and age it, that will improve it. So therefore they're going to want to do that. But if they have a choice, if they have enough storage space, they'll keep both. But because they're going to say there's going to be such a bumper crop that they're not even going to be able to do that, and therefore they're going to have to remove the old to make way for the new. So the Gemara finishes off. Omar Papa, Kol Mili Atika Malia, a general rule is that anything that's old, anything that's aged, any kind of food that's aged is good. But Lavami Tamri, with the exception of dates, the shichra and beer, the harsana and small fish. Specifically, elsewhere, the Gemara mentions kosa de harsana is a kind of gefilte fish that they had in those days, which was fish that were fried in their own fat with a little bit of flour mixed in. So, like I said, kind of like gefilte fish. That kind of thing is not good to age, but most other foods we're saying are. Continuing in the following perek with dinim of mekach u'memkor, dinim of buying and selling. The beginning of the perek is going to deal with dinim of buying of selling produce and the conditions under which it's being sold, in terms of if the quality is bad or whatever. And then later on in the perek, it's going to deal with sales involving real estate and continue into the next perek about that, this is the various sizes of buildings and other structures like that above ground and underground. So the Mishnah begins. Hamoicha peres lachavera. A person sells produce to somebody else. Now there are two things that, let's say, when we talk about produce, we could be talking about grain. The person might be buying grain in order to eat, to grind up and make flour, or he might be buying it to plant. And the buyer didn't specify one way or the other. Then he planted it, v'loitzamchu, and they didn't grow. So is the seller responsible? So now he could say that he could say, as far as I knew, I sold it to you for eating. I didn't know that you're going to plant it, and therefore I'm not responsible for the fact that it didn't grow. As we're going to work out in the Gemara in more detail. Vafilu zera pishtan, and that's true even if it's flax seed. Now, flax seed is edible, but most flax seed is bought in order to plant flax. So even though on the face of it, it seems more likely that he bought it in order to plant, nevertheless, there are people who buy it for eating, and therefore the seller has the ability to say, I sold it to you, figuring that you're going to eat it. Because, as we're going to see in the Gemara, when it comes to dinim mominis, we don't say ein hochen b'momen achar roiv. Shmuel is going to tell us in the Gemara. You don't go according to the roiv in dinim mominis. So even though it's only a minority of people who eat zera pishtan, nevertheless, since it is edible by that, and people in the minority do buy it for that purpose, then the seller has the right to say that. Now, by the way, I mean not necessarily would these dinim apply in different times and different places. Nowadays, for example, I think to begin with, when they sell grain for eating versus for animal feed versus for planting or whatever, it's labeled one way or the other because they have different amounts, different government inspections that they have to undergo or whatever. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about obviously in a place, in a time and place where they don't have such distinctions. Anyway, the Mishnah continues. Reb Shimon Gamliel Omer Zer Oyneg Gina She'en Necholin. Reb Shimon Gamliel says, where it points out, what about if you're talking about seeds that are planted in gardens which cannot be eaten? For example, let's say seeds of cabbage or leeks or things like that. You don't eat those seeds at all. Necessarily, he's buying them to plant. So then Reb Shimon Gamliel says, Chai Bachri Yosan, those he would be responsible to pay for because that's clearly Mekach Toros. Here he bought it that he obviously intended to plant it, and here it didn't grow. That Rashbam points out, it's like, for example, we had in the previous perek that you sold somebody, the understanding was that somebody was going to be buying from you olive wood, and instead you sold them shikma wood or whatever, or you sold them wine and it turned out to be vinegar or whatever. Each one has its use, but the fact is that's not what he bought. Here it's all the more so because what else is he supposed to do with cabbage seeds or whatever that won't grow? The only thing you could use them for is firewood. So therefore, Reb Shimon Gamliel says that he's chayev. Now the Gemara is going to point out Reb Shimon Gamliel is not arguing with the Tanakhama, even though the Mishnah says Reb Shimon Gamliel Oimer, which makes it sound like he's arguing. In fact, he's just explaining what the Tanakhama is saying. The Tanakhama had mentioned, for example, Zera Pishtan, which is a type of seeds that can be eaten, but in this particular case, in this particular case, it's more likely the guy bought them to plant. Nevertheless, you're not chayav b'achar yosan, but that's because at least they are edible as opposed to these types of seeds, which are not edible at all. Tosfos actually deals with the question that we learned back in Bava Metzia, that even so he could say that, you know what, you planted them wrongly or whatever. You could always say makas medinahi or something, or keep on trying to plant again and again. And so Tosfos discusses that there you have there you have exactly that. You have it's a widespread issue that that people's crops are not growing. Obviously, you can't say all of them did a bad job planting it over here, but here where it's one person, you could conceivably say, you know what, so that's why in that case you can't say that he did something wrong. And here also the point is, since he planted it, it turns out they really weren't suitable for planting at all, and you, the seller, should have known that, and therefore you're chayav b'achar yosan. So the Gemara starts a discussion which is eventually going to circle back to our Mishnah. The Gemara says, Itmar, we have a discussion of Amoroim. Person sells an ox to somebody else. Now, again, when it comes to selling an ox, there are two possibilities why the person might be buying it. He might be buying it to plow with, which the Gemara calls Liridia, or he might be buying it in order to shecht and eat the meat. So Amoicha Shoel Chaveiro v'nimtza Nagchan, and it turns out that this ox gores. Before it was ever sold, it was already a nagchan. Well, now you can't use such an ox for plowing. The only thing you're going to be able to do is shecht it. So what do you do? Rav Omar is a mekach tos. So Rav says this is a classic mekach tos because you bought this ox intending to plow with it, and now it's useless for that, and therefore you're entitled to void the sale and get back your money. Whereas Shmuel says no, because the seller could say, I sold it to you intending that you should shecht it. I didn't know, as the Gemara is going to work out in detail now, that I didn't know that you're buying it for plowing. As far as I knew, you're buying it for shechting. And for shechting, fine, even if it's a nagchan, you're going to shecht it, and that's going to be the end of that. So the Gemara asks, why is there a machloikus in the first place? Hagoros Habach adds the word amai, why is there a machloikus in the first place? First of all, that Rashbam points out, where again, Shmuel says that we don't go in things of dini mominus, acha haroiv. So Rashbam points out, it's actually, because we don't follow roiv and dini mominus, according to Shmuel, therefore, it's like we have exactly half and half. It's as if exactly half the people buy it for shchita and half for plowing. And therefore, so even sumchos that says momen amutal basafik chokin, that would be, for example, where we don't know the facts of the situation. You have the example in Bava Kama, which is where the Gemara also brings in this sugi over there, is you have the case over there, shosh nogach hasapara, an ox gores a cow, and then you find a dead baby next to the cow, and you don't know, was it that she miscarried because of the goring, and in that case, the owner of the shor is chayev for the death of the baby as well, or not, did she just give birth to a stillbirth or whatever, and only then was she attacked. And Sumchus says over there that Sumchus says over there it's momen amutal b'safek, and therefore chokin, therefore they divide the value of it. So the difference is though that Rashbam says they are based and doesn't know the facts of the case. When did the cow give birth? And then it doesn't matter even if one of them is claiming bori and the other one is claiming shema. We still don't know here. We know what happened. We know that he sold it to him. Then we find out that it was a nagchan. So even Sumchus would agree that's not called momen amutal b'safek. That would be, we go according to the one who has the stronger claim. And since we say, ein hochad b'momen achar roiv, says Shmuel, therefore, it would have been on the buyer. It should have been the buyer's responsibility to begin with to say, I want to buy this ox for plowing. And now when it turns out that it's useless for plowing, then he'd be entitled to a refund. So because he didn't specify, then Rashbam finishes off, then Shmuel would say that he loses out. Again, it's one thing, for example, if he told him, I want to buy wine, and the guy delivered him vinegar, he actually said wine. So here, if he had said, I want to buy an animal for plowing, no question, he'd be entitled to a refund. But because he didn't, then Shmuel holds that therefore he loses out. Okay, so the Gemara asks, so what's the situation? Again, I go, Sabach adds the word amai. Why is there even a machlokas? Let's see whether this person is buying it for shechting, and then we assume it's for shechting. So let's say, you know, it's not like nowadays where you buy things and you don't know each other at all. Here, but pashtus, we could be talking about they know each other. And he knows that this person is not a farmer, but he is a shechet, and he is going to be buying it for shechting, then we should assume it's for shechting. Eliridia, and if he knows the guy is a farmer, then he's buying it for plowing. Liridia, then we should assume it's for plowing. So why don't we why don't we look at that? So why would there be a machloikas in the first place? Let's see. Even if he didn't specify, even if he didn't say I'm buying it for plowing, if he's a farmer, then bepashtos, he's buying it for plowing. And the answer is begavra de zabin lahochi lahochi, because we're talking about a person who might well be buying it for either purpose. He is a farmer, but he's also a shechet, or maybe not a professional shechet, but whatever. He knows shechita and he shechts animals for himself. So therefore, the seller has every right to assume that the guy bought it for shechita, says Shmuel, rather than having to assume that he bought it for plowing. All right, the Gemara asks, "V'lechti domi hechininu." Fine. Here's another factor. Then again, why are Rav and Shmuel arguing? Why don't we take a look how much the guy paid for how much the guy paid for the animal? Obviously, an animal that he's buying for plowing is going to be worth more than one that's for meat. So the Rashbam explains at some length. Now, first of all, what do you mean the shechita mechartiv? The fact is, if he paid the amount that you would pay for an ox for plowing, then anyway, the amount of difference in price is going to be greater than 1/6, where we've learned previously that that's the threshold for oinah. And if the overcharge is more than 1/6, then you have bitul mekach. So here, what you have is it would have been worth a huge amount. If it's bought for plowing, it's worth only a much smaller amount. If it's a one-time thing for shechita, so you have definitely a difference of more than 1/6. So anyway, there's going to be bitul mekach. Now, the Rashbam goes on and explains at some length, what about, we learned previously that we had the machlokas of Yehuda and the Chachamim about if a person buys a tzemed, that doesn't include the word tzemed can mean a yoke, and it can also mean a pair of oxen with the yoke. And we have the machlokas of Yehuda and the Chachamim, whether the animals are automatically included. Rabbi Yehuda said that you can take a look at the price. For example, if you paid 200 zuz, he's obviously not paying that just for a yoke. So it means the animals are included. And the Chachamim say over there, Ein adamim raya, that the amount he paid is not really a proof. Because there are different considerations why he might have given him extra, even though he's only buying a tzemed. So the Rashbam explains, and in some detail, the difference is, as the Gemara explained over there, you're talking about those different terminology. Some people use the word tzemed to mean just the yoke. Some people use it to mean also the yoke together with the oxen. So therefore, you would have to be one of the ones who show, you would use the lekeach, would have to show that you're one of the ones who uses the word semed to mean the animal as well. Here, what it is that you're buying, it could equally well be for plowing or for shechita. So therefore, then the Rashbam says the Chachamim will agree that hadamim meidim, that you can look at the price and see what he was paying it for. And then see what he was buying it for and see how much he paid. That's how Rashbam explains. Tosfos also adds another point that here really what you have is there is a roiv and there is a roiv and there is a chazaka over here as well. We say over there that again, when it comes to the tzemed, you do have over there the roiv and the chazaka are on the side of the seller, because we said most people use the word tzemed to mean just the to mean just the just to mean just the yoke. Only a minority use it to mean the animals as well. So the roiv is on the seller's side, and also the chazaka, because he's muchzak still in the animals, as opposed to over here. The fact is, most animals are bought for plowing, and you have a roiv on one side, you have a chazaka on the other side, because the seller is muchzak in the money. So therefore, then we would say that the amount that he paid, it can be a proof one way or the other. So again, the question is then, why would why would Shmuel say that it doesn't matter and the seller can still say, I sold it to you for shechita? Why don't we say that the money should be a proof one way or the other? So the answer is Loitzricha de'iyaka bistra v'kombid me'ridya. The answer is that we can be talking about where the amount, the value of meat has gone up, and now the value of an animal that's bought for meat has gone up, and now it's the value of an animal that would be used for plowing. Another point, other points, by the way, before we continue with that, as far as this Ein Adomim Raya business. So again, we have the Rashbam and we have Tosfos. There are other. There's other explanations as well. The Rimi Gash says, and the Rashba brings him, that when we say Ein Adomim Raya, we mean that you can't use the money to prove what was actually sold. But here you actually have an item that was sold, and they both agree that it is. You sold me an ox. I bought an ox. The question is whether it fits whether it fits the conditions, whether he can say I bought it for plowing, or I bought it for shechita. And then the Chacham say that we can use the proof as a that we can use the money that you can use the amount that he paid as a proof one way or the other. So the Gemara answer is Leitzricha de'iyaka bistra. We're talking about the value of meat has gone up, become bedmeiridya, and now it's equal to the and now it's equal to the value of an animal for plowing. Rashbam brings, there's another girsa, which has the other way around, that the value of animals for plowing has gone down, and now it's equal to the value of meat. Same thing. In other words, the point is, so there's not really a you can't say adomim meidim, because under the current circumstances, you're going to be paying this amount regardless. Well, the Gemara says, Yehoch l'may nafkamina. Well, then what's the practical difference? Either way, you paid $100 for this animal. Right now, whether you're buying it for plowing or whether you're buying it for shechita, it's worth 100. So what's the so what's the argument in the first place? The answer is nafkamina l'tircha. There is the tircha involved that now he has to go and now he has to go and shech the animal because so he now he has to go and shech the animal right away and go and sell the meat and go find another animal to buy for plowing, but he doesn't want that. So therefore, so Rav argues that he can say it's mekach tos, and Shmuel says that no, the seller can say to begin with, you may have bought it for shechita. The price is not going to be a proof one way or the other because the price is the same either way. The fact that you have that tircha is not that problem. Is not my problem. Tosfos actually points out that on the face of it, the Gemara could have said that there's a nafka minna as well. That let's say that that originally at the time of the sale, the prices were the same, but afterwards it went down, or when it went down less than 1/6, the Gemara could have given those answers as well. But we're saying that we're talking about even the price remains stable, and still we're saying that and still we're saying there was the tircha involved. But we're saying that this according to Shmuel, the seller can say that's not my problem. Okay, so the Gemara asks, still heichi dami, fine, but what's the case where we're asking whether the seller has to refund the money? If we're talking about where the seller doesn't have money available to pay back, so he had already received the money, and since then he spent it. And now the lekeach is coming and saying that I want to be refunded. So then what's the problem? The akav tota bezuze. Fine. So if we're going to say that he's entitled to consider it mekach tos, then fine. All he has to do is why are we saying that he's going to return the ox to the seller and then he's going to say, well, now you seller owe me X amount of money as a refund? Instead, he'll just keep the ox and be paid that way. The Amri Inchi, after all, people say, min mori rosh vosach, from somebody who owes you money, pori ifra, be willing to accept even bran in payment. So why wouldn't we say that? Why would there be a nafkamina that we would say you take back the shur and you have to give me back my money? If anyway he doesn't have money available, then anyway he would just keep the ox in payment. Now the Rashbam brings, the fact is, we learned in Bava Kamma that we said that when it comes to almost anything in Dini Mominus, you are allowed to pay in Shova Kesef. You are allowed to pay in something that has monetary value, even rather than cash itself. So that being the case, then even if the guy does have money, why wouldn't he be able to say instead you keep the ox? So the Rashbam says that because that Gemara is talking about where he doesn't have money available. When we say Yoshev L'Rabbis Shava Kesef, it means exactly that. The person who owes the money, whether we're talking about a Mazik or a Moicher or whatever, the various possibilities of why a person might owe somebody else money, when do we say that he's entitled to pay with Shava Kesef? The Rashbam says is specifically when he doesn't have cash available for the purpose. But if he does, then he has to pay in cash, and that's what the Gemara is at. That would be what the Gemara is saying over here. Then a number of Rishonim say that way. So in other words, the idea is if he has money, then he has to pay with money. If he doesn't have money, then we're not going to put him to the tircha of going and selling it and getting the money together. So that would be what the Gemara is asking over here then, given that we're talking about that the seller doesn't have money available right now to refund him, then the seller is not going to be required on the face of it to take back the ox and go and sell it to somebody else and bring the money to the original buyer. He would just be able to tell him to begin with, you keep the ox, because after all, I could have paid you with an ox to begin with because I don't have money on hand. So that's the question. Why doesn't the Lekeach do that? Why are we asking about a refund? Now, Tosfos discusses a different girsa. Tosfos discusses a different girsa. Idil lesnu lahani zuzi. Not if he doesn't have money to pay. The girsa we have in front of us. Idil lekali shalom mine. If he doesn't have money available to pay. Tosfos brings a different girsa. Idil lesnu lahani zuzi. If that money that he was paid for the ox is no longer available, meaning he may have other money, but that particular money he already spent. So Tosfos discusses then in that case, the Gemara is saying that still on the face of it, he should be able to pay with the goods, with the Shava Kesef, rather than with the money. So Tosfos draws a distinction between a Baal Choyv, when you owe somebody money because you borrowed money from him, there the expectation of the Malva is that you're going to be paid in money. So we're saying if he doesn't have money then at all, then he's able to pay him with something else. And we have, for example, throughout Shas, where he's paid with Karka. But where he has money, then since the guy did him a favor and lent him the money, then therefore, then he expects to get back cash rather than objects. As opposed to when we're talking about a sale over here, where there we would say that to begin with, the Gemara is implying over here that he could pay with Shava Kesef even if he has other money, as long as he doesn't have this money anymore. Then Tosfos goes on to bring another opinion from Rav Chaim Katz, from Rav Chaim Kohen Tzedek, who was one of the big Talmidim of Rabbeinu Tam. And he discusses that even by a Baal Choyv, even if he has money, he has the choice of paying with whatever he wants. He would have the choice to pay with something else, even with a Baal Choyv, unlike what Tosfos was saying earlier, according to the first opinion, that when it comes to a Baal Choyv is different. And Tosfos goes on and discusses that a little bit. Tosfos goes on to say that Rabbeinu Tam used to say that there were three distinctions within a Baal Choyv. If he has money, then he has to give him money, Rabbeinu Tam would say. So then he can't get away with giving him something else. If he doesn't have money on hand, we don't tell him that you have to go and sell something for it. When it comes to Nizikim, then it doesn't matter either way he can pay with anything. Tosfos discusses it over here. There's other places where Tosfos discusses all the ins and outs of this as well. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara over here. So the question is, again, according to the Rashbam and many other Rishonim, and according to the Girsa we have in front of us, the question is that right now the seller doesn't have any money to refund him, so why don't we say anyway that he would keep the ox, that the buyer would keep the ox and resell it to somebody else, or shecht it and keep the meat, since now we're saying that the price of oxen for meat is the same as the price of oxen for plowing, or according to the Gersen Tosfos, Ida Lesnu Lahanu Zuzi, then it would mean similarly that he doesn't have that money anymore, that particular money he spent. And again, why wouldn't he be able to just tell him to keep the ox? So the answer is the answer is that the case where Rav and Shmuel would be arguing about, and where Rav is saying that he's entitled to send nekachtos, is in fact where the seller does have money, and he is able to pay back with that. So again, the Rashbam brings over here in this whole discussion of when you're allowed to pay with other goods, when you're allowed to pay with money. So he brings from Rabbeinu Chananel that when it comes to a malva and loiva, where he has money available, then he can't say, I'll pay you back with other nechasim. He has to pay him back with money. The Rashbam says, I don't really like that. I don't really like that. What's the difference whether he has money or somebody else or something else? So no, only if he has. So if he doesn't have money, then he's entitled to pay with other things. But if he has money, then he has to pay with money.
Why can't he be made to borrow against his animal?
Because the Gemara tells us in Baba Kama that when the Pasuk says Yoshiv, that when the Pasuk says that a person, for example, who caused a nezek to somebody else has to pay, l'rabis shava kesef, the word Yoshiv comes to include that he can also pay in something that has the monetary equivalent, v'afilu subin, even bran. So that's the thing. So Rashbam and Rabbeinu Chananel and the various opinions in Tosfos are all arguing over the parameters of that. When do we say that he's entitled to do that versus when do we tell him that when do we say that he has to pay in money? So again, Rashbam is learning if he has money, then he has to pay with it. And only when we're saying over here what we're saying over here in the Gemara is if he doesn't have money, then we don't burden him with going and raising cash for it. And then again, you have these different opinions over here. So again, the Rashbam brings that Rabbeinu Chananel learns that Yesh Mi Sha'omer, that if the money for this shirt itself is available, then he has to pay back that money. But the Rashbam says it doesn't really matter. As long as he has money, he has to pay back in money. And again, Tosfos is saying, following Rabbeinu Tam's way of looking at it, that yes, not Rabbeinu Tam's, following Rabbeinu Chananel's way of looking at it, yes, there might be a difference between a Baal Chayv and where after all, when the guy lent him money to begin with, he expected to get back cash, versus other kinds of transactions where there we might say that he is in fact entitled to pay in Shavu Kesef. And again, you have Reb Chaim Cohen's opinion and so forth. So now again, we're talking about that the Moicher does in fact have money to pay. According to the Rashbam, he has any money. According to Tosfos, he has the money that he received for this actual animal. So now the question is, does he have to give back that money or can he tell them the Shechit Mechatiblach? That would be the scenario where Rav and Shmuel are arguing. So now Rav Omer Hareza Mechachtos because Basa Ruba is linen. So now Rav says, listen, we have to go according to the Rav. The Ruba Leridia Zabni. Most people buy oxen using them to plow. So even though, yes, as we talked about in Amun Aleph, we're talking about this buyer conceivably could have bought it for Shechita, and he does, after all, Shecht animals as well. Nevertheless, since most people buy for plowing, then we have every right to assume that he bought it for plowing, and therefore we're entitled to send nakartos. And again, since we're also talking about, as we just established, where the seller has money available, any money according to the Rashbam, the specific money he received for this animal, according to the first opinion in Tosfos, then he should have to refund it. Or Shmuel Amalach, where Shmuel would answer you, no, he has linen basa ruba. You know, when we say that we go according to Roiv, the Isura, in matters of Isur v'heter. For example, you have the classic case that the Gemara brings in several places. You have a city where there are nine stores selling kosher meat and one that sells trefa meat. And we say that if you find a piece of meat in such a city, so we say if you go into the store and buy, then that's kavua. That's a different matter, which we're not dealing with over here in the sugya. But if you find a package of meat that you know came from one of those 10 stores and you don't know which, then you're allowed to follow the roiv and say that there's a 90% chance that it's kosher and you would be allowed to eat it. So when it comes to matters of Isser v'Heter, Shmuel says, then we go according to the roiv. But when it comes to Dine Mamonis, says Shmuel, We do not go according to the Rav, rather we go according to Chazakah. So here, where the here, the seller is muchzak because he has the money now. So therefore, he'd be entitled to say that as far as I'm concerned, you bought this animal for shchita, even though that would be the minority, and therefore you can't make me repay it. The Torah actually does bring from the Ramah that says that it's true if, on the other hand, if the money hadn't changed hands yet, then you have the other way around. Then the chazakah is on the side of the buyer, and then therefore we wouldn't make him pay the money, because then we would say the chazakah is on his side. We're talking about where the money already changed hands over here. So the Gemara brings Simon Isha Ve'eved Shor Shvarin Uperis. These are key words for the next few cases the Gemara is going to bring from various Mishnayos and Braises to try to prove one way or the other about whether we can prove that Rav or Shmuel's opinion is supported by Mishnayos or Braises. One of them is going to be our Mishnah at the bottom of Tzadik Gimel Amud Aleph, which is why we're bringing in this whole sugya over here. So the Gemara says, Meisvi, I have a contradiction on Rav. A Mishnah says in Masechet Ksubos, Her isha shenis almana or nisgarsha. A woman was widowed or divorced, and now she's coming, she wants to collect her ksuba. Now, as we learned in Masechet Ksubos, now she's saying that I lost my ksuba. So the Rashbam says there could be two possibilities. Obviously, if she has her ksuba document, we're going to take a look at it and see. We know, of course, as we learned in Masechet Ksubos, that a besula, when she gets married, is entitled to a ksuba of 200 zuz. And if she'd previously had relations, she's an almana or grusha or whatever, then she's entitled to only 100. So here, either she's saying that I had my ksuba and I lost it, so now we can't look at it to see what her status was, or there were even places, and we learned in Masechta Ksubas, there were places where Bechlau, they didn't write a written ksuba in the first place, they would just rely on the Takonas Chachamim that there was a minimum of 200 for a besula and 100 for a ba'ula. So now, one way or the other, she comes to Beis Din with this kind of claim, so she's saying, I want to collect my ksuba. She says, I was married when I was still a basula, and therefore I'm entitled to 200. And he, her husband, if she was divorced, her yoshim, if she's widowed, are saying, Loiki ela amona nesasich. He says, no, I married you when you were an amona, and therefore you're only entitled to 100 zuz. So what do? So the Mishnah says, Im yesh edim sheyotze behinuma, if there are edim who say that she went out to her wedding with a hinuma. We learned over there in the Gemara what a hinuma is. It's a kind of canopy or a kind of veil that they would do that they would use specifically for a basula when she's getting married. So if she had that, Virosha Parua, and they saw that her hair was uncovered. Now, if she had already been previously married, she'd have to keep her hair covered. So here that they see that her hair was uncovered and like a basula would be. And in fact, and hanging down to her shoulders as basulas would usually have it. So then ksubasa masayim, then she's entitled to a ksuba of 200 zuz. Because even though the Edom don't know whether she was a basula, but they see these things that are normally done only for basulas, and therefore we can use that as a basis for saying that she was in fact a basula. So now the Gemara says, let's analyze that. Taima de Ikka Edim. Why are we saying she's entitled to 200 in that case? Because she has these Edim about the Hinuma or about her hair. Haleka Edim, implying if she hadn't had Edim Loi, then she wouldn't be entitled to the 200. And we would say that she would say that her husband or her Yoshim have to pay only 100 for Huxuba. Now, Vamai. Now, why? According to Rav, who says that in Dinim Mominus, we go according to Rav, Lema Holochacha Rav Anoshim, why don't we say we should go according to the Rav of women, the Rav Noshim Basulis Nisois? And most women do get married as Basulis, and therefore, so that alone, according to Rav, should be reason enough for her to get 200. Tosfos points out also that we can't say that he would have a migui, that he could say I paid it off, because Rav himself holds that in a case like this we don't apply a migui. He says that Rav says, yeah, that in a case like that, you're entitled just with a get alone. She's entitled to the ikur ksuba, and he doesn't have a migui. So Okay, so the answer is Amar Ravina, Mishum de'ikalameimar. The reason why, according to Rav, in this case, you wouldn't apply a roiv is as follows. It is true that we can say roiv noshim besulis nisais. It is true that most women do get married that when they're besulis. Umiyot almonas, it's true that only a minority of women get married and almonas. But are married as almonas. But we have another consideration as well. We have another roiv that's we have another chazaka that they're supposed to be. V'chani sas besula yesh l'koil. When a woman gets married as a besula, then there's a koil for it. It becomes well known. Everybody makes a big to-do about the wedding. V'zu hoyo v'ein l'koil. Here there was no koil. It doesn't seem there because, in other words, the point is there was a simcha. There's a tremendous simcha when a woman is getting married for the first time. So people tend to remember it even a long time afterwards. V'zu hoyo v'ein l'koil. Here there's no koil. Itra la ruba. So therefore that weakens the roiv. So therefore that makes it maybe more likely than it otherwise would be that she is part of that miyut who was married and as an almana. So that would be why Rav says you don't go according to the roiv, because in this case the roiv is weakened by that. So Tosfos points out the fact is it is true you do have a roiv still of roiv noshim besulis nisais, and because of that the Gemara mentions in Ksubas that the Mishnah mentions in Ksubas that even you have most of the time we don't accept edus from a person of what happened when he was a child, but there are a few examples where we do, and one of them is this, that even a child, if he remembers that she had a hinuma, etc., then we accept that as evidence that she was a besula. So again, because over there, because the fact is there is a roiv even without there is a roiv even without the coil. Nevertheless, though, we're saying that without the coil, that roiv is weaker. Anyway, so they want to ask why? On the contrary, e kol anisoris besulis yeshlan coil. Well, then, what do you mean? If you're telling me that whenever a woman gets married as a besula, then automatically there's a coil because there was a big simcha. Well, ki ike edim my havi. Then we have to ask when. Then what? How does it help us if there's edim? Mi de les la coil. Given that there is no coil in the first place, sahadi shkorininu. Doesn't that make it more likely that these are false edim? How could they be saying that she had a hinuma? When there's a hinuma, there's going to also be a coil, and here there's no coil. Shouldn't that make it more likely that the edim are false? So you're telling me, in other words, that like this, she doesn't have the roiv on her side because there was no coil. But once there were edim, then they can establish that she was a basula. On the contrary, we shouldn't trust the edim either. And the answer is Ella. No, it's not that kol hanisois besulas yeshlan koil. It's not that automatically when she gets married as a besula, there's automatically going to be a koil. But it's rather Ella roiv hanisois besulas yeshlan koil. Rather, the way we have to learn it is most women when they get married as a besula, they have a koil because of the simcha. But the fact is, there is a miyut that not v'zu hoyo ve'en la koil. Since there's no koil in this case, itra la ruba, so that weakens the roiv for her, but it doesn't eliminate it entirely. Therefore, when we have the edim on her side, then fine, that helps her and she can get her 200. But the Mishnah can still be understood well according to Rav that we would normally say we go according to the roiv here because the roiv itself doesn't help her because there's a weakness in it. Therefore, we need edim. But other than that, if it hadn't been for that, then Rav would say we could have gone according to roiv in the first place. So no proof one way or the other from that Mishnah against Rav. Okay, the Gemara brings Toshma. Let's try to bring another proof. Again, let's try to bring another proof here the other way around. Let's see that we do go according to Roiv when it comes to Dine Mamanus. So this would be a question on Shmuel, who says that we don't. A Mishnah says, a Braisa rather says, Hamurcher Eved Lachaveiroi, a person sells an Eved, an Eved Knani, and in Shas in general, when we use the word Eved unspecified, it means an Eved Knani. So a person sells an Eved Knani to somebody else. V'nimtza ganav oikuv yustus. It turns out that this Eved is already previously was before he sold him, is a ganav, he steals money, or kuv yustus. The Rashbam explains over here, and Rashi similarly explains in a few other places that a kuv Justus is a kidnapper. Tosfos disagrees with that, and based on for a few considerations. First of all, the Gemara is going to say that most avodim are suspect of such things. You're not going to say most slaves are kidnappers. So rather, Tosfos brings that Rabbeinu Hanan learns that a kuv Justus is misachet bekuvia, is a gambler. Anyway, so you find that this Eved is one or the other of those things, a ganav or kuvyustus, higiyoi, still he's reached him, meaning in other words, we tell the buyer, tough luck, you don't have the right to cancel the sale because of that, because so fine. So the guy is a ganav or kuvyustus, nevertheless, the sale is still valid because tough luck, that's not a reason. The he'll still work for you as a slave. On the other hand, listim mizuyan. On the other hand, if it turns out that the slave is an armed bandit and he's going to be soon caught and executed, or muchtav, or he's written in the king's registers, again, meaning that Ashbam says that he's chayav misa, so therefore, so now he's going to be useless as an eved because he's going to be useless as an eved. He's soon going to be killed. So then, the seller can tell to the buyer, here it is, it's yours. In other words, you take him back and you're going to have to refund me my money because you sold me, in effect, a dead man walking. So now the question is, Reisha, my timer. Now, why in the Reisha do we say that tough luck? He keeps the slave anyway. What do you mean? The guy's a ganav or a kuvyustus, and he didn't explicitly say that I'm willing to accept the slave no matter what mumim he has. So lav mishum deruba hachi isnehu. Wouldn't it be because we should assume most avodim are like that, ganovim or kuvyustus, and therefore we would say hochan mamaman acha roiv. So we see that we do go according to the roiv, and therefore the seller has every right to say, yes, you should have realized that roiv slaves are like that. The answer is loy fulu hachi isnehu. The answer is no, we don't say that. We would actually say all slaves are like that. All slaves, we can assume, are like that. So if we only said it's roiv slaves, then we would say that the lakeach didn't know, and therefore maybe he should be entitled to a refund. And the braisa is saying that not. But we're saying that all of them are like that. So it's as if he befedush told him, I'm selling you a slave who is a ganav or a kuvyustus, and therefore you have no right to say that you want the sale to be voided. But when the eved is actually going to be chayav misa for one reason or another, then he has the right to say, listen, most avodim are not that. And the fact is, you sold me a dead man walking, and therefore for that I am entitled to a refund. So that doesn't prove Rav's point that we go b'momen acha roiv, because here we're not talking about a roiv, we're talking about we're talking about over here a certainty. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, with other proofs that the Gemara is going to try to bring one way or the other in this Machlokas of Rav and Shmuel.
Yeah.